You're listening to the New Evangelicals Podcast. Welcome to the New Evangelicals Talks. I'm Tim, the host of this segment. Join us every Monday as we talk to all different kinds of people at the intersection of theology, politics, and culture, helping you navigate a better path forward in your faith. Hello, friends. How we doing? Welcome back to another episode of the New Evangelicals Talks. And this one, I've been getting some amazing guests on the podcast, and this is no exception. I had Brian McLaren on. He wrote this book, Life After Doom, Wisdom and Courage for a World Falling Apart. Brian, if you want to know Brian, you really should. He's been around for a long time, one of the early emergent church movement leaders, phenomenal author. And so I had him on to talk about climate change. Yeah, he's writing a book on what do we do in the face of so many different crises. Is that the word, plural? I don't know, crises, whatever. But so many issues that are facing our time, including the climate and what we do with that. So this is a deep conversation. We cover all different aspects. We talk about the bad, but then we talk about life after doom. Like, what does that mean? What does it look like to face empire and to say we have to do better? So, man, what an honor it is to have Brian on the show. He's become a mentor and a friend, and I'm so grateful for his work. Friends, thank you for being here. If you like this episode, give us a rating and review. Give us a subscribe to the podcast channel on YouTube. And we are a nonprofit holding space for thousands of people as they navigate a better path forward in their faith. If you want to support the work that we do, you can donate. All of our work is paywall free. What does that mean? We have no Patreon account. There is no secret episode if you pay us X amount of money. Nothing we do, whether it's our community stuff, our Zoom groups, our podcasts, our YouTube, whatever, there's no barrier financially to entry. And that's made possible because of people like you. Again, if you want to support our work, you can click the link in our show notes. All donations made in the U.S. are tax deductible. Your donations are the lifeblood to making this content possible. Enjoy this conversation with Brian. Talk to you later.
Hi, I'm Diana from Albany, New York, and I'm a TNE donor. I donate because it's helped me immensely as I process things like the evangelical support of Trump and its response to COVID and the treatment of LGBTQ people. Keep up the great work.
All right. Well, Brian McLaren, it's great to have you on the podcast. This is, I told you this, I think, in private, but this is truly a full circle moment for me because I read your stuff when I was still in my evangelical days. Like, I read your work on the emergent church and all that stuff. And I was like, oh yeah, Brian McLaren, like, he writes some great stuff. And, you know, here I am now, you're on the podcast. We're talking about a new book that you've written. We've become quite friendly behind the scenes over the past few months. It's just a real honor to have you on the show. Thank you.
Well, let me say, I listen to your podcast and I love it. So I'm really happy to be on the show too.
Wow. Oh my goodness. That is crazy to me. Well, like I said, your work in so many ways, I mean, arguably has been one of the most influential people, I think, for a lot of folks navigating a better path forward beyond that basement of fundamentalism that we always talk about. And you, yeah. I mean, you've written a lot of books, a lot. I think your most recent one up until this point was Do I Stay Christian? Is that correct?
Yes.
That book, I listened to it on audio, legit brought me to tears. Like, I felt so seen and heard. I felt like, oh my gosh, exactly. This person gets exactly what I'm saying. So I want to thank you on behalf of the audience. That book, I think, is just such an important book for us to read because you really weigh out very honestly the pros and cons of like, hey, do I stay? Do I go? And I think, you know, for me, I found a very compelling case in the reasons to stay, but I like that you also give compelling reasons for people to go, right? Where they say, you know what, you know, Brian, I read the book and I landed here. And you're like, hey, I understand because there are some compelling reasons. So thank you for writing that book. It really means a lot. It really does.
Well, thanks.
Okay. So we're talking about a new book that you've written because that's just what you do. You write amazing books. Life After Doom, Wisdom and Courage for a World Falling Apart. This book comes out, what, in a few months?
Yeah, in May.
Okay, in May. Awesome. This book, as far as I understand it, is really about addressing climate change. Is that correct?
Well, yeah. You know, there's a term you may have heard, Tim, people are using called, the term is polycrisis. Because when you take climate change And you look at that, you say, well, we could solve this, except for the fact that we have these people undermining democracy and funneling more and more power to a super wealthy billionaires, and they're working against dealing with climate change. And then we've also got this problem of white Christian nationalism and white supremacy and various forms of religious nationalism around the world. And you start putting all of these different problems together, and more people are feeling, well, the way I use the word doom, life after doom, I'm not talking about, you know, the end of the world in that sort of sense. I'm talking about the feeling that descends on a person when they think we are in such deep trouble. Each of our problems is making the other ones worse. I don't see a way through. And that feeling of just being overwhelmed is the context for the book.
Well, man, it's again, like you're back in my head and in the head of many of the audience, because I hear from them all the time. And I think about this too. I mean, lately I've been thinking a lot about how we live in the world's wealthiest country. We're still worried about medical debt. We know that, like you said, white Christian nationalism is a thing. Democracy is under threat. Wages are low. The middle class is slowly being erased. And, you know, it's just, there's so many, to your point, there are so many different things that are each in their own right, their own crisis.
Yeah.
And then we also have climate change, right? Now, I've talked to people like Catherine Hayhoe, a leading climate Scientologist on the podcast before, with her book that came out a few years ago. And so, you know, I do think that in the progressive evangelical world that I occupy, because a lot of people are navigating their own personal maybe trauma or just a better way forward mentally, climate change kind of takes a back seat, even though we all know it's a major issue. Yes. So I think it's important that we have books that are like, actually, no, this is actually potentially one of the biggest crises, because if we have no environment to live in, none of this other stuff matters.
Yes. Not only that, but every issue we care about is going to get worse as the climate is under greater stress. When the climate's unstable, our economic systems are unstable. When our economic systems are unstable, our political systems are unstable. Also our religious systems, because when people are tight financially, they find it harder and harder to give. Yeah. So you put all those together and we're in a lot of trouble. One of the things I try to do in the book is help people see that climate change is, pardon the pun, but the tip of the melting iceberg, because underneath it is the larger problem that I call ecological overshoot, or this is the technical term for it. And ecological overshoot simply means when we are sucking more resources out of the earth than the earth can replenish and pumping out more waste products than the earth can neutralize or detoxify, then we're in a situation where we're destroying our own life support system. And the problem is we have been doing that intensely for the last 40 years. We've been doing it destructively for the last 200 years. And we have been on this course, you know, for a very, very long time. So overshoot is the deeper issue that I think, and this is where our faith comes in, I don't think we're going to be able to deal with the deepest root problem without a deep spiritual transformation. And it's not bringing people to where we are as Christians, but it's helping Christians and others move to a new place that I think will make us better Christians in the long run, and help Hindus be better Hindus and Muslims be better Muslims too.
Yeah. So in the research for the book, is that what you really found, that like over the past 200 years or so with the Industrial Revolution, that's when really this crisis started to really develop very quickly because of just how resource heavy those systems are and how we're not able to, the earth isn't able to heal as quickly as we're damaging it. Is that kind of how, what we're talking about here?
Yeah. So look, the big deal is fossil fuels. Like toward the end of the book, I have this chapter where I talk about what I've been learning in the research process and epiphany moments. And one of them was the almost magical power that fossil fuels have. Like if you were to say one barrel of oil, I don't know what the current cost is, but it usually hovers, you know, slightly over $100.
Right.
One barrel of oil, it would take one individual working full time between 6 and 9 years to produce as much work, physical labor, as can be extracted from one barrel of oil.
Wow.
I mean, when people let that sink in, the incredible, and it's not a surprise, because when you think about it, fossil fuels were made by the decaying bodies of living creatures who absorbed sunlight over millions of years and concentrated it in this black substance. So when we discovered fossil fuels, it set us on a course that has brought us to where we are. So it's not just the fossil fuels. It's that they made it possible for us to dig deeper and faster and plow up more things and create more chemicals. And you put all of that together, and we've been on this accelerating hockey stick of a graph toward facing the limits that, for those of us who take the Bible seriously, whether or not we take it literally, in the very second chapter of Genesis, human beings are given limits. And part of the essence of the wrong that's committed in the early chapters of Genesis is refusing to live within very modest limits that we were given.
Yeah, you know, this is actually a good point just for the audience to kind of hear, and as I'm unpacking it with you. So the big issue with fossil fuels is not just the emissions that they emit. That is a part of the problem, but that it accelerates our ability to do things very rapidly and very quickly. That can include how we harvest minerals, how we, you know, chop down trees, how we build new systems, et cetera. So it's not just, I mean, the emissions are a huge part of it, I'm sure, but it's also the fact that it's kind of been like hitting the fast forward button on the tape, right? And just made us really go real quick, but the earth is still at normal speed.
So put it this way, who would have guessed this? People will be shocked to hear this. One of our big problems right now is we have a shortage of sand. Now you think, hold it, the ocean's covered with it.
Okay, what?
But when we build, we make concrete, and concrete requires a certain kind of sand. It requires sand with rough edges. The sand on the beach is smoothed off. It's little round spheres largely. So sand that can be used in concrete is we're really running short of it, right? Well, why is that? Because fossil fuels have enabled us to build so much more so fast that we've used up all the easily available, or most of the easily available, construction sand. So everything gets accelerated. Mm-hmm. Our population skyrocketed. The amount of almost everything that growing population uses has skyrocketed. So not only do we have more people, but we have more people eating more beef and more pork and more chicken. Something, as I worked on this book, that just shocked me. The full impact of this hasn't sunk in yet, right? But, you know, if you were to say to people, of all the mammals on the earth, what percentage of them are chickens, pigs, and cows, right? When you look at the biomass of domestic animals, we're squeezing wild animals less than 20%, less than 50%, less than 15%, less than 10%. And so all of what we will call wildlife is being replaced by domestic animals because we eat more, because we have more prosperity. And all of this comes from this sort of magic potion that we discovered of fossil fuels. I mean, if for folks who've read C.S. Lewis, it's a little bit like Turkish delight.
Okay. Yeah. Now, I grew up in conservative evangelical spaces, right?
Yes.
I grew up on a steady diet of talk radio, Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, Michael Savage. I can name them all. Bob Grant back in the day. I mean, I had all these people in my head. And it seems like the narrative that I understood was something along the lines of this. Hey, climate change is greatly over-exaggerated. Yes, the climate is changing here or there, but it's probably not man-made. The earth has normal cycles. And then my evangelical upbringing would reinforce that theologically by saying, listen, we're called to have dominion over the earth. The earth is here for us to be able to use to promote human flourishing and human life.
Yes.
Give me your response to that kind of rhetoric now as you did the research on this.
Okay. So much to say about this, Tim. Let me start by saying that Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity and all the others, they actually provide a great service. They teach people to be skeptical of the claims of other people, but they do us a great service. They do not teach people to be skeptical of their own claims. They draw people into a group that's skeptical of the other political party or the other economic system. And they never, and meanwhile, they play every trick of misleading people that they accuse the other side of doing.
Yes.
So when you stop and say, the fossil fuel industry has known the damage it was doing since the 1970s, certainly the 1980s, and they hid that information and they started funding fake think tanks to put out propaganda. So whether Sean Hannity actually believes that stuff or whether we should be as cynical of Sean as he is of other people, I don't know.
Right.
But what they end up doing is promoting massive amounts of information. So here's what I'll say. As someone who spent, I wrote a book on global crises in 2007, 2008, and I became unusually informed about our situation during that period. And then in the years that followed, I've kept up with it, but I did another deep dive. And here's what I could say. Anyone who has not studied our climate crisis and the larger ecological crisis of overshoot, anyone who's not studied it, all I can tell you is it is so much worse than you think. I'm not even asking you to study it. I mean, because if you do, you're going to have to deal with psychological stress that you know, a lot of people know this. Young people, millions and millions of young people around the world are saying, I don't want to have children because the amount of information they've taken in has made them think we are in so much trouble. This doesn't seem fair, right? Mm-hmm. So the thing I can say is they are wrong. And the information is readily available and so is the propaganda. In fact, one of the chapters in the book, I did a deep dive over the last couple of years in all of the climate skepticism literature. And I took seriously, you know, chased everything down that I could. And so, yeah, it is dangerously bogus. Can I give you just one quick example?
Please, the floor is yours.
There's a guy who's very big on YouTube and on all is interviewed by all these people. And he says, here's what he says. He says, the leftist woke, you know, mob tells us that carbon dioxide is bad, but carbon makes plants grow. And so we're, by putting more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, we're the best friends of the environment. We're saving the earth. We aren't destroying it. So, I mean, that statement gets cheers and applause and makes people feel great. He tells people, we aren't creating trouble. We're heroes. People love it. They eat it up. It's like a jelly donut for crying out loud. All fat and sugar, you know, but it's just a lie. It's just false. And the examples go so far. It just shows incredible either ignorance on the part of this fellow or deception on the part of this fellow. Just a quick example, more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Every time it rains, a little bit of rainwater mixes with carbon in the carbon dioxide and falls as carbonic acid. When carbonic acid falls in the water, it acidifies the water and the oceans are becoming more acidified. When oceans become more acidified, all of these little plankton that need to build little shells and zooplankton they're called. And there are phytoplankton this affects too. They can't survive in a slightly more acidic ocean. When the plankton in the ocean decline, the little fish decline. When the little fish decline, the big fish decline. You create these cascade effects. And that sort of simplistic statement. Look, I'm a preacher. I know that there is a temptation to say the things that get you applause and amens, right? And that kind of talk, I've listened to so many tapes of these people and they get all of this applause. And it is so sad and so dangerous.
One thing I appreciate about you is that you're willing to really think through like how someone else would see something to better understand so we can respond to it, which I appreciate. In your estimation, as you were writing this book and, you know, as someone who's been involved in understanding our climate crisis, what is the main motivation you believe for the fossil fuel industry and for others and even these pundits to maintain this illusion that, hey, actually it's not nearly as bad? Because if they do know that we're heading towards a crisis, they have to know that long term this affects them too, even their business, right? Yeah. So like what am I missing here? Why would someone go, Exxon, for example, hey, you know, let's just kind of suppress some of this data because we want profits early. I mean, is it a profit thing? What's your best read on that?
Yeah, I think it's complex, Tim, is an honest answer. I mean, here's the truth. Nobody becomes an executive in Exxon or BP or, you know, wherever. Nobody comes an executive there without spending years in the business world.
Right.
And the business world is geared toward not asking, is this moral? Is this healthy? Is this good long term? They're geared toward the quarterly reports of shareholder return. Yeah. In fact, until a few years ago, it was illegal in the United States to build a company that mixed shareholder return with social benefit. They had to create a new kind of, corporation called a B Corp that made it legal to put social and environmental benefit as a legitimate form of government. A legitimate form of corporate structure and corporate planning and leadership. And so I think people get shaped by this sense. We're making a lot of money. Our shareholders are making a lot of money. The entire economy is built on fossil fuels.
Yeah.
Changing will be difficult. Mm-hmm. And here's the other part that gets into it with politics. I was in a meeting, I tell the story in the book, of evangelical leaders called the Sandy Cove Conference. And at the Sandy Cove Conference, they brought together environmental leaders across denominations and parachurch organizations. I was so excited to be there, although at that point I wasn't really considered an evangelical by a lot of people. It really is my background, and I love the evangelical community. And I was thinking, I'm going to meet the other evangelicals who care about the environment. Well, it turned out that very few of them knew much about the environment, but they brought in incredible leaders. People would be shocked to know that the former head of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change was an evangelical Christian from England named Sir John Houghton. And Sir John made a brilliant presentation there. By the way, the IPCC, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, is the largest joint scientific endeavor in the history of the universe on Earth, meaning more hours of more scientists have gone together in this collaborative venture to understand the Earth's climate system than any other project, moonshots, developing the atom bomb, everything else. This is just the largest project. And the head of it was an evangelical Christian. And so he and other evangelical leaders made presentations. And by the end of the first morning, everybody was convinced this is real. And the Bible calls us, out of love for God, love for neighbor, love for this precious earth, to do something about it. The leaders of a particular denomination that I won't mention here, I mentioned in the book, their representatives were there. And he said, I'm sorry, our denomination will not support this. And, you know, why won't they? Because this is such a big problem that it will require government solutions. And we are conservatives and against big government. So we will oppose anything that requires big government solutions. So at that moment, it was not theology. It was economic ideology and partisan affiliation that caused the limit. I'll tell you one other little happy ending to that. Not happy ending, but that I didn't tell in the book. 2 days later, someone raises their hand and says, you know, the Clean Water Act produced, now I've forgotten the exact number, like a 3-to-1 return on investment. He said, you know, for every dollar we spent to curb water pollution, we created new technology that made us $3 or $4 or $7, whatever it was. So he said, there was profit in clean water. Maybe there will be profit in climate change, addressing climate change. And suddenly all those heads turned and said, oh, we like the sound of that.
Friends, I am so excited to be partnering with Middle Church to promote their event, Freedom Rising, happening April 26th to the 28th, sponsored by the Candler Foundry and happening at Marble Collegiate Church in New York City. This is a 3-day conference that you do not want to miss. Find rest, learn how to organize political power, and dream expansively about the world we deserve. And let me tell you, this is a monster speaker lineup with absolute legends, including Dr. Jackie Lewis, Reverend Dr. William Barbara, Reverend Dr. Kelly Brown Douglas, and Robert P. Jones, the founder of the PRRI Institute, which is the place I get all of my Christian nationalism data. This is going to be a three-day event full of learning about how to take care of you and your body, how to take action on crucial issues, and how to live into different ways of being in the world. I plan on being there, and I cannot wait to see you there as well. Get your tickets now at freedomrising.org and be part of this transformative experience. That's freedomrising.org, April 26th through the 28th in New York City. I'll see you there. You move the world. I wish I can say, wow, I'm so shocked that a conservative evangelical entity would be not on board for, you know, fighting climate change because of the government. There is definitely a pipeline, I think, between this like conservative American evangelical world and this very much strong aversion to the word climate change, right? Like, because in my estimation, so many white evangelicals are steeped in talk radio and conservative media and right-wing media that I tell people those places plant little landmines in people's heads.
Yes.
And whenever they hear certain words, no matter who says it, oh my God, liberal, this is woke. Yes. And, you know, I have to say this is bad. And climate change is one of those words that has become one of those landmines for people. And what's frustrating to me about this is, again, I want to be clear, like as a former more fundamentalist thinker, even back in the day, I was like, guys, I'm not sure what the issue is. If we know that we're polluting and harming the climate, if we know that our climate is shifting and that can hurt people, and we're called to be good stewards of the planet that God has created in six literal days, of course, obviously, don't we have an obligation to do everything that we can to steward this planet well? And the analogy I would use often is, if a friend of mine gave me his Ferrari for the day, which for the record, I don't have any friends who own Ferraris, but if they did and I borrowed one and I, you know, took it off-roading and, you know, went to McDonald's and just, you know, dumped some fries in the passenger seat and dumped a Coke in the back and brought it back full of mud, they would not be very happy because they entrusted me to respect it and to use it for what it was designed for, right? So this is not like a mind-blowing liberal agenda. This is pretty logical to me. Yet in those spaces, there is such a strong aversion to anything climate change related, and it's very frustrating.
Amen to that. It is very frustrating. Let me add two little pieces to this. When Rush Limbaugh was still alive, I used to listen to him for surveillance purposes. And I used to say to evangelical leaders around the world, but especially around this country, I would say the most powerful leader among Christians in the United States is not Billy Graham. It's not Pope Francis. It's not, and you could mention any number of theologians' names. It's Rush Limbaugh. He is in people's heads. Was it 3 hours a day? Or
3 hours a day, 12 to 3.
And so for 15 hours a week, there were people who were his disciples. He sat at their feet. Yes. And since then, Rush, I mean, it's hard to imagine people more destructive than Rush. But, you know, now you add Sean Hannity and Tucker Carlson, wherever he'll end up, and all of these other folks who, you know, have even more sinister and sometimes scarier personalities. Like with Rush, you felt, at the end of the day, he's an entertainer. He loves attention and he loves money and he's getting a lot of it and so on. But some of these other people, you get the feeling there are other things going on, you know? So yes. All that's to say,
yes.
We have a generation of evangelical Christians and Catholics. People don't realize there's a parallel thing in Catholicism that have been shaped by a very mean-spirited conservatism. But let me say one other thing about the theology, because this is where you could not, like I'm thinking of the Screwtape letters for everyone who's read, like this is something you would imagine Screwtape would design, because what happens when people see the earth is in trouble and you convince them that's in trouble, they say, Jesus is coming back anyway. This is all prophesied in the Bible. It's God's will. In fact, I have had so many people say this to me, Tim, Jesus is coming back. We might as well get all out of this earth that we can while we can. In other words, let's return the Ferrari in as bad shape as we can. That will please God, since God wants to destroy it anyway. And this is where, you know, and a lot of people don't understand that eschatology of the rapture never existed in Christian history until the 1830s. It was a gift to Christianity from my denomination that I was born into. So, you know.
Thank you, John Nelson Darby. Thank you so much. That's right. Well, just two quick points on this. Number one, you're totally right on the talk radio thing. In fact, I tell people all the time that white evangelicals are disciples of Tucker Carlson, not of Jesus, right? Yes. That's who they're following. That's how I kind of frame that same idea. And you're also right. I have noticed, and you're talking to someone who, my dad was a blue collar business owner. Talk radio was on all day. And I went to work with him a lot when I was a teenager and young adult. There is an evolution of rhetoric that has evolved from even your Sean Hannity's. There's a reason why Sean Hannity does not speak at Charlie Kirk's Turning Point USA event, right? Mm-hmm. But Tucker Carlson does, Ali Stuckey does, Candace Owens does, and of course, Charlie Kirk does. Yeah. It's a different level of rhetoric, of extremism, and of dehumanization. And I'm emphatic about that. So you're totally correct that like the world that Rush and Sean have built has now another layer of Tucker Carlson went to Russia to interview Vladimir Putin and gave him softball questions and then went to the grocery store trying to demonstrate how much more affordable and how much better the grocery store is in Russia than compared to the US without telling people that the average wage that people make in Russia actually makes that bread much more expensive, right? Like that's the level of propaganda we're talking about here. Yes. Something I couldn't even picture Sean or Rush ever doing. So there's definitely another notch, I think, above of like where we are now. To your other point, this is so important, the theology. I have heard Ali Stuckey, she's a right-wing conservative commentator, say from her platform of probably a combined over a million followers that, hey, God is sovereign over all. And the Bible says that the seasons will never really change because God's sovereign. So no matter what we do to the climate, it doesn't matter because God will sustain it anyway. I mean, that was said to millions of people. Right. And so I agree. The theology really matters here because if you believe that, A, this world's going to burn up one day anyway, and you're going to get raptured up to the clouds, or that God is sovereignly in control of the seasons, no matter what man does, that's going to impact how you view the actual data that we have that actually the world is heating up quicker than ever. And it's going to create major catastrophes and kill a lot of people in the process.
Yes. 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 That's right.
Yeah.
And it's heartbreaking. And this is why, you know, it's why it doesn't just make you angry it makes me angry, but it even more, it breaks my heart because you realize that people say these things and feel pious and they feel they're just repeating what people they trust said to them. And I tell a story near the beginning of the book. My maternal grandfather, Stephen Smith, was one of the best human beings I ever met. And on my best days, I hope I'm half as kind as he was. Born in the 1890s, lived through an amazing life, was a wonderful father and a perfect grandfather, in my opinion. But he had that theology taught to him. And I tell the story of we were driving somewhere and I asked him, what happens when we pump all the oil out of the ground? And his answer was, God put all that we need into the earth and it will be there until Christ returns and we'll be okay. Well, what I realized, he sincerely believed that. There was no malice in his mind.
Right.
And he was born in the 1890s, for crying out loud, a different world, you know. But that theology is still out there, and young people deserve to not have to follow that way of thinking.
I agree. So we've talked a lot about doom. My poor audience is probably depressed as hell right now, thinking, "Oh my God, if Brian McLaren says that that things are doomed, we're really in trouble." Let's talk about the life after the doom part, right? Because and this is arguably even more important because most people that you're talking to are well aware of these things. Like I have said very little that is new to them. You probably have given them some new data on some things, but they all know, you know, the concerns that we talk about. Yeah. And it is a very important question to ask. What does life look like, you know, in the face of so many pressing issues that are affecting a lot of people and could affect, are going to affect future generations, right? I have kids. I have two kids under four. And I have thought about this, like, what's the planet going to be like in 25 years, 40 years, 50 years when I'm not here anymore for my children? Give us some of your thoughts. What does the life after doom look like?
So in the book, when I use the word doom, I am talking about the trauma that hits our nervous system when we realize that the future will not be the same as the present and the past. Now, we don't know what it will be and all the rest, but we just know there's going to be a lot of change and a lot of turmoil.
Yeah.
And then I think what happens, I'll tell you what's happened to me as I've tried to process this. I've taken my identity. If I imagine that my identity is fused with the values, it was shaped by the values of our current civilization, a set of values that is obsessed with profit, shareholder return, build as much as you can, as fast as you can, and don't worry about the costs you'll deal, you know, the unintended consequences, you'll deal with them later. If I say, I've been shaped by that. And then I say, part of what has to happen is I have to disembed my identity from that set of assumptions and try to imagine, is it possible for me to be me and live with a different set of assumptions and live with a different set of values? Would I be a better person or a worse person if that happened to me? And my sense is that suddenly a verse from the New Testament, like Romans 12, do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind. Suddenly it feels like that verse was written for our current situation. What can happen for us is that we will become deeper, wiser people who are not shaped by the assumptions of our current civilization, but begin to see. And the irony for those of us who grew up with the Bible and love the Bible is going to suddenly make way more sense than it ever made because the Bible, people haven't thought about this, but when Jesus was speaking to his fellow Jews in the first century, they were part of an arrangement with the Roman Empire that was making some people very, very rich and making other people very, very poor. And suddenly, when you just have that little insight and you read Jesus' parables, they look very, very different. And when you read what he says that we think is about the end of the space-time universe, what if what Jesus is talking about is the end of civilization as we know it, the end of our current socioeconomic structures? Well, first of all, it turns out to be true because in AD 67, the Jewish people revolted against the Roman Empire, and then they were crushed by the Romans, and the temple was destroyed. Imagine that, you know, the whole center of their religious structure. And they had to figure out a way of being faithful people who believe and follow God after the very central structure of their religion was shattered. The priesthood was shattered. No more sacrifice. The whole thing. And so suddenly you realize, oh, the Bible in many ways is a set of documents helping people cope with the end of whatever civilization they were part of, imagining surviving through it and living beyond it.
I think that's really wise. It's one of the reasons why I just can't shake the Bible, right? Yes. It's complicated. It's mysterious. I have to undo a lot of my evangelical lenses that I was given to read it in ways that did not do me a lot of good in so many ways. But you know, when you quoted that verse in Romans 12, I was like, oh, my Awana days are back. I know that verse. I've memorized that verse. And it was always used though, right? In the sense of like, don't be conformed to what we think about culture regarding certain types of music, or if you say certain words, or if you wear certain clothes, or even in my case, have certain haircuts. Yes. That was kind of how that was interpreted. But when you think about it in the scheme, in the context of empire and of the values empire has and the values that capitalism has, right? I think that's when it becomes that subversive, upside down kingdom ideal of like, well, yeah, I mean, obviously we're shaped by the world that we live in. We can't get around that. But how do we shape our minds around this kingdom living, so to speak, that makes us think about these systems and the consequences of this particular empire we find ourselves in, and how in this context, it's pillaging the environment and also pillaging other countries and other continents and leaving them massively impoverished while we suck up those resources, right? Yes. And that to me is talking about renewing my mind and not being conformed to the patterns of quote unquote this world.
Oh my gosh. Exactly right. Exactly right. And when you think, you know, the first thought of a person is, hold it. Jesus couldn't have meant that when he said, may your kingdom come. It wasn't, could Jesus have meant may a new way of living, a new value system come in this life? And he wasn't just talking about us going to heaven after we die. He was talking about a new way of life. And Paul couldn't have meant that when he said, don't be conformed to this world. But then you let it sink in and you think, if that's what Jesus was talking about, if that's what Paul was talking about, they are 1,000 times more brilliant and fascinating and important and relevant to today.
Yeah.
And what's so sad for me about evangelicals, you know, my heritage that I share with you is that we really cared about evangelism. Mm-hmm. And now in this marriage that evangelicals have made with white supremacists and con artists and the fossil fuel industry and all the rest, in that alliance, they're driving people away. There's almost nobody left they can evangelize. They can only evangelize people who already agree with their politics and all the rest, because nobody in their right mind would accept that. And the irony is, we need good news more than we ever need it. If we only had some people who were sharing the good news, that the real good news that Jesus talked about.
100% People ask me often, why the evangelicals? Why keep that in your title? I'm like, listen, to be an evangelical means to be someone who brings good news. And I don't think evangelicals are bringing good news. Can we bring some good news back? Like, can we say, hey, we have some good news to bring here that isn't rooted in this, you know, supremacy mindset and this mindset of empire and capitalism and, you know, it's not about for me that people have different political views than I do. I understand that. It's a big world. People are going to see things differently.
Yes.
But there's something very unique about this far right media world that just espouses time and time again half-truths and whole lies to intentionally get people freaked out about something that isn't as big of a deal as they're making it, or that will distract us from real issues. You know, while really right now in white evangelicalism, they are concerned about critical race theory, DEI initiatives, and the quote-unquote groomers, which is a dog whistle for queer people. Like, those are not the biggest issues facing our country right now. You know, the predatory school loan system is a big issue. The fact that during the pandemic, corporations and the ultra wealthy exploded in their wealth while the middle class and lower class lost a ton of wealth. We can't get affordable healthcare. I can think of 15 more pressing issues than your concern about a DEI initiative that Chick-fil-A is doing. Like, who cares about that? My goodness, it's crazy.
It's crazy. And here's the sad thing that I never knew when I grew up evangelical. I didn't know that this is not the first time this has happened in, in evangelicalism.
Yes.
Like, when you think, you know, I didn't know about lynchings and the Great Migration. I wasn't taught that in school. I didn't know about it. I learned about it later. While lynchings were happening across the American South, Christians across the American South were worried about making alcohol illegal. They were trying to not just ban, instead of banning abortion, they were trying to ban alcohol. And so they were obsessed with that and had nothing to say about terrorism against Black people and terrorism against white people who believed in the equal rights of Black people. That's in our history. My gosh, you know?
Yeah,
but again, I suppose part of it writing this book has helped me understand is it's not just evangelicalism that's messed up. And it's not just Christianity that's messed up.
Yep.
Our whole, the assumptions of our civilization have proven untrustworthy. And we now are at this point of needing to rethink deeply. And the only question is, how much pain do we're like an alcoholic who's drinking too much and can't quite admit it yet. And the only question is, how much pain are we going to cause ourselves before we hit bottom, ourselves and others before we hit bottom?
What is up? This is Trip from the Homebrewed Christianity podcast, and I am pumped to tell you about Project Amplify. That is something that the new evangelicals are up to. It's a new endeavor. And guess what? I've been a longtime supporter of T&E, and when I heard about Project Amplify, I'm like, oh, junk. That sounds great. Why? Well, when Christianity shows up in the public square, I usually have a hard time associating with its content with, I don't know, what Jesus said and did and endured and testified to in the one he called Abba. Well, if you want people that are deeply engaged in communicating in our current medium and you want to support it so I don't know, maybe what pops up in your algorithm doesn't make you want to hurl and call Jesus and say, hey, you need some new PR, then maybe you should be a member supporting what's going on at Project Amplify. I'm excited about it. So check it out.
I I like to be very pragmatic, as you know, Brian. We talk about this a lot. Like, okay, let's just get some stuff done here.
Yes.
You know, I know that I think about my, I know that I'm in America in 2024 and I live in an environment where I have to make ends meet. I have kids to take care of. I have to be able to afford healthcare. You know, we're a nonprofit. I solicit donations to try and make my income happen, yes, plus everything else, right? And there are just certain things that I participate in that I know are problematic. I use Amazon Prime for business. I know Amazon is problematic, but also, like, I know that I have a budget to work within and they usually have an affordable price. So we spend donor money wisely, for example, right? That, yes, that's just one kind of like, yes, circle of like, oh, there's tension here.
Yes.
Do you give, and if you do, what kind of advice do you give the reader of like, hey, here's some steps we can take, yeah, as an individual to maybe help be part of the change that we so desperately need to see when it comes to things like climate change and other doom scenarios?
Yes. So here's what I do in the book. I say there are really only two things that you can do that are really, really significant. Mm. The first is you can vote for people who take the well-being of the earth seriously. And second, you can talk to everybody you can about your concern about the earth and about us having a better relationship with the earth. Because one of those helps us politically move in the right direction, and the other helps us move the social needle that will help us move politically in the right direction. Those are the two big things. Lots of other things you can do. You know, for example, I've really cut down on my flying, but I still fly. I plan to stop flying totally at some point. But the truth is, that's not, I'm doing that because of my conscience. It's not because it's a high leverage change, you know? So what I did in the book is I put an appendix where I made a list of all of the kinds of changes in lifestyle that you want to do when you don't want to keep harming the earth, right? Mm. And what I basically say is, look, all those things we can do because we want to and because we're motivated to, and it becomes part of our trying to set a good example. But the bigger changes are changes of the whole system. And our individual work will be overwhelmed by the larger currents that are going on in our world. So voting is a big deal. Mm. And Catherine Hayhoe says this all the time, talking about it is a big deal. And she's absolutely right, because talking about it helps let there be a contagion of genuine, sincere concern to counteract the barrage of BS that comes through some of the people we were talking about before.
Yeah, I love Catherine's work and her book. I think it's called Saving Us. I have it on my shelf. She talks a lot about how part of her work is being in places that might hear the term climate change and think liberal agenda. But then she shows farmers how, hey, actually the environment that you're in, we both can see is changing, right? Because the farmers can see how weather patterns are shifting and how, you know, certain kinds of things are an issue. And so I love her work of being in those spaces, helping people realize that this actually affects them, right? And to think about more sustainable ways that we advocate for a planet that can be more sustainable for future generations, et cetera. The other thing she said, I'm not sure if you know this off the top of your head, but she said to me something like the amount of emissions that like the majority of like emissions that come out of our yes, systems, you can fit those CEOs like on a bus. It's like, yes, 75 or 80 people. Yes. And that number, I was like, oh my God, yeah, like, are you like, wow, yeah, that is mind blowing to me. And sometimes I feel like there is something to this notion that these companies get almost too big to fail, right? We're like, yeah, Amazon, Apple, Google, et cetera. You know, yes, our mind cannot comprehend the sheer scope and size in terms of volume, money, and reach that, yeah, these companies have. And yet they're also some of the biggest exporters of emissions that are harming the planet. And we participate, yes, in that. I have an iPhone. I'm using a Mac. I have, yeah, AirPods. Like, yeah, I'm a big consumer of their, yeah, stuff, yeah, because I love their stuff and I, yeah, need their stuff now, yeah, to do this work. So, yeah, I just get stuck in this cycle of chaos in my head.
You know, and this is one of our challenges. We have to develop not just sort of black, white, good guy, bad guy thinking. We're all, yeah, part of a system that's bad. And now we have to participate in a transformation of the system. And in the book, I outline four scenarios of how that process could go. But here's the weird thing. When we start thinking about business,
yeah,
in some ways, the last 18 months or so have been the most encouraging period of time in all of our work against climate change. Last year, the government of China and the economy of China produced more renewable energy equipment, solar panels and so on, that has ever been produced. In the past year, we saw a greater increase in the use of renewable energy in the United States than ever before. Our capacity to store energy in batteries expanding like crazy. And a lot of that is because of good government policies that then encourage businesses to do good things. But here's right now, I would say business and science are helping us make progress more than religion or government. But we need all sectors working together because, you know, my friend and one of my heroes, Bill McKibben, says, winning too slowly is the same thing as losing. and that's why we're in a timed test here. And we need all of us working together with a good attitude and avoiding simplistic good guy, bad guy thinking. And this is sadly, it's one of the things that the fossil fuel industry tried to promote. A lot of people don't know this, but they tried to promote the idea of the carbon footprint so they could make you and I feel guilty about this or that as a way of distracting and deflecting attention from the deeper complicity that they have with the problems we face.
Well, it kind of reminds me when someone like Dave Ramsey is like, listen, just work hard and make more money and you'll get out of debt. And it's like, well, when your starting salary is $500,000 compared to like $50,000, it's a very different kind of ballgame, right? And same kind of thing here where it's like, yes, I get that my plastic straw could be a problem here for the environment, but also comparing Exxon's emissions to my straw is like ridiculous, right? Like there's a much bigger issue at play here. Yeah, that is very helpful, I think, for me and for folks out there, because I want to do good work. I want to change, you know, the systems that we're a part of. And I do think last thought on this for me, I'll hand it back over to you, is we've seen the government work with business to do amazing things. I mean, one example of this is Project Warp Speed, the vaccine initiative. Like the Trump administration worked with business and science and they funded it and they worked together and we got a COVID vaccine out in record amounts of time. So government and business, I think, do have a role to play and they can work well together to get stuff done. And so I think that's one example of what happens when we see things as like an all hands on deck situation, and we're all playing our part to hopefully curb climate change.
Oh my, well said. Yeah, I mean, the something that's important to remember is that there are millions of people, maybe a couple billion people, who get this and are doing what they can and we're trying to lean in a better direction.
Yeah.
There really are great people and there are amazing things happening in business and amazing things happening in government. My feeling is the world of religion is really a key player and we need people in the world of religion to show up and to stop being part of the problem and start being part of the solution. Yeah. And when we face the deeper issue, a change in values, a change in our relationship with the earth, to learn to see the earth as in a real sense, God's temple, you know, that this is God's beautiful handiwork, God's art gallery. And our bodies are not separate from the earth. Every breath we take in means we're taking in part of the earth. And I don't mean to be too graphic here. Every time we eat food or go to the bathroom, we're reminded that we take in matter and get energy from it and put matter back. We are porous to the earth. We're part of this thing together. And that's, to me, that enhances my spirituality. It makes me sense how I'm joining with God in the healing of the world, or I'm working against God in the desecration of the world every day. And I think it adds a lot of meaning and joy to life when we can join with God in loving and healing this beautiful world.
I do love how your definition of getting too graphic is talking about, you know, the waste that people, you know, excrete. But hey, that's fine. I'm all about it. I think we have a lot to learn from indigenous communities with how they relate to the land, right? And I am very, very surface level on this. I know very little. I have more work to do on it. But there's something that I've realized about my environment, and I think this industrialized world we live in, that disconnects us from the earth itself, right? Yes. We don't think about nature and the land as like a living, breathing, moving thing that has a life to its, you know, all in of itself that helps, that is part of the cycle that we all occupy along with humanity, right? And so that holistic approach, I think, will give us a renewed sense of respect for maybe we own property, for how we treat our piece of property, how we treat, you know, parks in the forest and the oceans. Because you're right, there is what they call it. It's like the fine tuning method, a hypothesis, right? Of like, hey, whether we agree on a creator or not, the earth is very dialed in and very fine tuned. And if we start messing around with some of those levers, it's very quick. One domino leads to another and things are way out of whack. And so we have an obligation, right? Especially as Christians who believe that God breathe the breath of life into all of this and called it good, that we have an obligation to realize that the energy of God, the life force of God, is in the planet. I'm not saying God is the planet, but God's breath is inside of it, moving it and shaping it. And it's kind of like almost, I'm not sure what the word is, but it's almost like, you know, it's like almost idolatrous in a sense, or it's just so dehumanizing to God, I guess, to treat the planet like it's our own garbage pit, because it's just so much more than that.
Well, I know our time is almost up, Tim, but let me say, I have two chapters in the book. One is called Don't Read the Bible, and then in parentheses, The Same Old Way. And what I ask people Love to that. Do is rediscover the Hebrew people, the Jewish people, as indigenous people. Mm. And what we have in the Hebrew scriptures is indigenous people who are resisting colonization. I have some rabbi friends who have an organization called Trua, and their tagline is resisting tyrants since Pharaoh, which I love. But if we could rediscover the Bible as indigenous literature, and then Jesus shows up, a tribal man, a member of a brown-skinned member of a tribe, and who knows his tribal lineage, and he tells us, look at the birds of the air, look at the flowers of the field. Jesus looks like he's bringing us indigenous wisdom, trying to help us understand our relatedness and connectedness. And one of the reasons I really hope evangelicals will read this book first is because I think it will help them rediscover treasures in the Bible and in Jesus that they'll appreciate. But second, in the kind of change that we need people with passion. And this is something that a place I would love to still have the word evangelical is that passion and joy and vitality and confidence entering the world with a sense of mission.
I love that. I think even science is showing us how we're all interconnected. I mean, I always mispronounce her name, but Ilia Delio, I believe is her name.
Ilia Delio, yes.
Yeah, she is. I mean, I've heard some of her stuff. I've heard some of her talks. I mean, if you want to have your mind blown on rethinking what prayer might or might not be, listen to some of her stuff, you know, and how it relates to things on the quantum level. So anyway, I'm going to nerd out on that later on. But yeah, I mean, I'm with you on this, right? Like there is something beyond just this cultural framework that we've overlaid onto the environment that we live in, right? And it's important for us to not be conformed to that pattern of the world, so to speak, and to think about things through that decolonized lens and also that indigenous lens of like, maybe there's wisdom that we're missing out on because what we've mapped onto our culture certainly might have some benefits, but also kind of we just lose out on some of the mystical elements, some of the mysticism of like, there's something special happening here and we should see it that way. So I think that's really important. I totally agree with you. It's wonderful. Well, that was fun. It's a good conversation.
Oh, so good.
Friends, the book is Life After Doom, Wisdom and Courage for a World Falling Apart by Brian McLaren. Book comes out, you said, in May. Is that correct?
Yes.
All right. Good. I'll make sure I put a link in the show notes. Brian, if folks want to follow, I mean, I'm sure they all know who you are, but in case someone doesn't, in case someone's like, whoa, who's this dude? How can they find your work? Where are you online, website, et cetera?
So the easiest place is go to my website, brianmclaren.net. MCLaren.net. And then there's links to all my social media there.
Awesome. Love it. Brian, great talking to you finally publicly. We'll talk more offline. Thanks for being here.
Thanks.